maybe a little bit more.
June can be warmer.
But even like a few weeks ago, it was a little bit warmer than it is now.
Last week, 2 days were very hot.
Very hot, yes.
I see.
But this is about it.
I see. I thought June would be okay.
It's so unpredictable, isn't it?
We can have
a heat wave tomorrow.
No, I saw the 7-day forecast in BBC and other, and they said heavy rains this morning.
Yeah.
So last evening,
yeah,
I got an umbrella.
Just like that.
This morning, I didn't get to use it.
I thought you were cold.
But we need the rain
just
desperately.
Like
we haven't had any rain for ages.
Yeah, with no April showers, were there?
And when you have a garden, you know, you wait for. We have to water all the time with the thing. But it's all topsy turvy anyway, with the weather.
It's global warming.
Yeah.
But if it's closed from one side, it's
that's
dry
it.
Or something.
Dry side, yeah. I think.
I don't know if Kia's coming.
Why don't you take your jacket?
No, I have my jacket.
It is chilly, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. To do some tapas.
There is something coming in here, isn't there, from there?
Shall I shut that?
Is it the window?
Oh, the window's
well, I think Professor Kumar likes to open
the just a little
bit.
Everybody has his
own. I don't mind it.
Because if it's closed, then I don't know, some dry.
It gets very stuffy in here.
Yeah, so
closed.
I get some throat irritation.
Oh, do you? Oh, sorry. Yeah. So, welcome to the second Tantric Studies seminar. Last week was just an introduction, and this week we're going to look at Shaiva traditions. And then next week we're going to look at the Pancharatra, so be the Shaiva traditions today we'll be looking at, particularly the Shaiva Siddhanta, and what's called Kashmiri Shaivism. We'll be looking at some of those traditions as well. I don't know, is Keo going to come, or should I just start?
He's going to come back.
I just thought, okay, yeah.
Leo.
Keo. What I'm going to tell you, the historical mapping of what I'm going to describe today is mainly based on the work of Sanderson. So, well, it is completely based on the work of Sanderson. So I'm going to describe to you today, well, the first half anyway, Alexis is a mapping of the Shaiva tradition. So it's kind of potted version of his research, really. That's what I'm going to present today. Because he's mapped out these traditions and our knowledge of them, and indeed of Indian religions generally, is transformed because of his work. So Shaivism then is I'm going to speak about Shaivism generally, and then look at the Shaiva Siddhanta, then look at the what's called Kashmiri Shaivism and the non-Siddhantika traditions. What is Shaivism? Shaivism are the traditions. Focus is Shiva Shasana, the teachings of Shiva, focused on Shiva and his or her consort or energy, Shakti. Now, Shaivism goes back. The earliest sort of systematic Shaiva tradition, I suppose, is the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, where you get the Rudra as the Lord Ishvara, who's the Mayin, who's the creator of the Maya, the creator of the web of illusion, as it were. And you get the three realities of the soul, the world, and the Lord. So it's a kind of qualified theism. There seems that it's not completely monistic like the Brihadaranyaka in the earlier texts, but it's there's a qualified theism in there. So that's an early kind of Shaivism. If the Mahanarayana or Upanishad or the Bhagavad Gita are early kinds of Vaishnavism, so the Shvetashvatara is the Shaiva equivalent, really. And then that feeds into Puranic Shaivism by the early medieval period, and that's what I want to talk about now. So you get Puranic Shaivism and non-Puranic Shaivism. And non-Puranic Shaivism is distinguished from Puranic Shaivism by initiation. So the worshippers of Shiva, the smarter Brahmins who followed the Smritis, called themselves Maheshwaras, which is just a general word for those who followed Maheshwara, which is named for Shiva. And they believed that liberation was being in the Shiva Loka. You go to the top of, here's the world egg, like this, and at death, if you're a devotee of Shiva, you go to the top of the universe, to the Shiva Loka, the top of the world egg. Another system in the early medieval period, between the 7th and 10th, 11th centuries, began to develop, which are broadly called non-Puranic Shaivism. Sardison calls them non-Puranic traditions. And these were characterized by diksha, or initiation. So you're initiated into these traditions, and a Shaiva is technically somebody who has undergone diksha. So the technical term Shaiva, although it's used generally to be follower for Shiva, a Shaiva is distinct from a Maheshwara, because a Shaiva has undergone an initiation which will guarantee him, and sometimes her, liberation at a later, at death, or within 7 lifetimes, perhaps.
I just got a bit muddled. The Maheshwaras are
These are Brahmins. The Maheshwaras are Brahmins, smarter Brahmins who are following the Puranas, who believe in the Puranas. The Puranas are sort of narrative texts and genealogies and sort of histories and all sorts of kind of rich kind of material. And there's based on different deities like Shiva, Vishnu, and the goddess. So
and a diksha is by
Diksha means initiation. What separates these Puranic traditions from the non-Puranic traditions is diksha. So you're initiated into the traditions through diksha. And technically a Shaiva is one who follows the teachings of these non-Puranic traditions. And Maheshwara follows the teachings of these Puranic traditions. That's a kind of technical distinction between the two. Now these non-Puranic traditions are in turn classified according to two broad distinctions. One is called the Ati Marga, which means the higher path or the outer path, and the other is called the Mantra Marga, the path of mantras. Now the word Tantra hasn't come up yet, and it's a bit it's not a particularly useful way of looking at these traditions at this time, I think, because like the texts of the Ati Marga are not technically tantras, but all the texts of the Mantra Marga are tantras, call themselves Tantra or Agama, but mostly Tantra. Now the Ati Marga, the higher path or the outer path, calls itself the Ati Marga because you know the five stages of life, the five ashramas in traditional Hinduism. There's five stages of life. There's a student stage, a householder stage, a hermit stage where you retire to the forest with your wife and perform rites, and then the renouncer stage where you give up, you burn your sacred thread on fire and perform your own funeral and become a renouncer. Those classical four stages. Now the Ati Marga were a group who saw themselves as the fifth ashrama, the one beyond the fourth. They transcended even renunciation, were even better than the renouncers. We've got this fifth stage. And there were a number of groups classified under the Ati Marga, the most important and famous of whom were called the Pashupatas. And the Pashupatas, those who followed Pashupati, which is another name for Shiva, the lord of the Pashus, the beasts, the animals. And the Pashupatas became incredibly strong and influential in medieval India. They were an ascetic group, but who attracted patronage of kings and supported kings in medieval India. So Somnath, this famous temple at Somnath, was run by the Pashupatas before Mamun of Ghazni came and kicked them out or sacked the place. And they were in South India too, became very important, very influential there. And they transformed into a group called the Kalamukkas. But part of their practice, although they worshipped in Shiva temples, was to seek liberation through this fifth ashrama, this fifth path, this higher path or outer path. And there were different three stages of practice for these. First of all, you live near a temple, and as an ascetic, wearing the linga, worshipping the Shiva linga, the iconic and iconic form of Shiva. Worshipping Shiva with song, dance, and laughter, it says in one of the key texts of the Pashupata Sutra by Kandinya, which is a later summary, if you like, of the teaching. So it's pre-10th century, this text, but the Pashupatas go back much, much earlier. And so, first of all, you live near a temple as a male ascetic. Secondly, you abandon external signs of an ascetic. You leave the temple and you go to the marketplace, it says in this text, and behave as if mad, and roll around and pretend that you're crazy. And you make lewd gestures to young women in order to get abuse. It's a bit like a building site or something. And you get... yeah, and then you, through this antisocial behaviour, you gain the merit of the of all these mysterious microphones appearing.
disconcerting. I get a thing to speak.
I can't imagine anybody possibly wanting to listen to any of this. Any
this is on the web, right?
Well, they're going to put it on the web for some reason. Yeah.
Are you going to?
Well, I'm not going to, but it's true. Well,
I don't say anything then. I've got a very interesting story, but not with that thing on.
Oh, I'll turn it off then.
You should go ahead.
No.
I've seen this. I have seen this in a Shaivai temple. This madness with rude gestures.
Oh, yes.
Shocking rude gestures.
Yes.
And total unacceptable sociable behaviour.
Yes.
But pushing everybody's button.
Yes.
And making them think. Wonderful.
Oh, how interesting.
Really,
how interesting.
Really great.
Yes. So
it breaks the sort of norm, doesn't it, and gets you over the edge.
Antisocial behaviour.
But there is a lila in it. There is a teaching in it.
Presumably it's partly to break down usual habitual ways of thinking and that kind of thing, I imagine. Well, although the text says the reason is to get the karma of the people who are abusing you. So if you're abused by people and you're a holy man, you get their good karma, so you get their merit.
Yeah.
And that's a way of accumulating merit for yourself. That's what it says in the text. So it's a bit like there's the cynics in Greece, so it's extreme antisocial behaviour, but there's probably other reasons for it as well. But the text says it's for gaining merit. 3.12.17. And then the third stage is where the sadhaka, the practitioner, withdraws to a private place and lives off alms, meditates on the mantra, on five mantras of Shiva, and finally withdraws to a cremation ground, becomes a shmashanavadi, a dweller in a cremation ground, and dies. Lives whatever's available. Lives on whatever's available. And then he reaches Rudra Sayujya, union with Rudra. That's the goal, Rudra Sayujya. So that's the Atimarga. And although they were ascetics, there were also an order that became extremely important and powerful in medieval India, had patronageable royalty and supported kings, and became very wealthy because, of course, they didn't need anything. And so everything that they got, they were able to build on temples and gain land and get married. There's a guy in Edinburgh, Peter Bishop, has written very interesting work on the Pashupatas. So he's written a book, Early Shaivism, which is all about them, really.
Now you can see there this cremation ground tradition. Now the mantra marga is the other distinction. Before I go on, one last thing about the Pashupat is that they take the great vow, the Mahavrata, which is a vow that in the law books, if you kill a Brahmin, you're supposed to walk around with his skull for 12 years as a penance, as a vrata, as a penance or a vow. Now, there was the founder of this sect was said to be La Kulisha, the lord of the club. or La Kulisha, I can't remember if it's a short part, La Kulisha, yeah. Who is the who is said to have taken this great vow for killing a Brahmin, and you lived outside of Vedic society carrying the skull of your victim for 12 years. So Manu 1173, it says that, it describes that practice.
Why would you want to do that?
It was as a penance for your, you've killed a Brahmin,
you've done the ultimate
sin and ultimate crime, so you wonder, I don't know how you get his skull, I suppose. You go to his funeral, I suppose.
So it's like enlightenment through by doing the worst possible deeds.
I suppose
it's darkness, sort of a paradox, isn't it?
It is a bit like that, I suppose. But I think
homeopathic almost.
Homeopathic
almost.
The tantra is homeopathic in many ways. But this the great vow is a punishment. It's intended as a penance, really,
to
cleanse yourself of this sin that you've done. But
interesting.
I'm so slightly confused. So that Mahabharata is carrying of the skull, or does that include also killing of Brahmins?
No, I don't think it includes killing of them.
Okay.
Just the carrying.
After you have killed, then.
I think all this. I mean,
and
this
attract
is rhetoric,
the
it?
Sort of despise then from everybody, but they know that it is a sacred act, isn't it?
Yeah, although
everybody.
They're living outside of the pale, outside of any society, if you kill them. I mean, whether it was a real thing or whether it was just a kind of rhetorical, whether it was a literary trope, it's difficult to say. What's the relation between these texts and social reality in medieval India is very difficult, I think, to establish. But certainly there was the La Kudishas, who are another bunch like the Pashupatas, related to the Pashupatas, followed this Mahavrata, this great vow. And then these groups were transformed into the 11th to 13th century, especially in Karnataka, into a group called the Kala Mukhas, those who's black faced ones, I suppose, the Kala Mukhas. Was Alexis told us a story about those? I can't remember what it was. Do you remember what it was, Kia, about why they have black faces?
Yeah.
I can't remember. And then they became the Lingayats, and the Lingayat community is still very strong in Karnataka. So that's the kind of lineage there. The transformation is into the contemporary community of the Lingayats. They trace their descent from the Pashupatas and the outer path, the Atimarga. On the other hand, the Mantramarga, you can be divided into, which is based on the revelation of the Tantras. These Atimarga aren't based on the Tantras, don't revere the Tantras, so they're conventional, they're Vaidika in many ways, but they say that they transcend the Vedas because they're the Atimarga, the higher path, but they don't revere this alternative revelation called the Tantras that I spoke of last week. So you get the Shaiva Tantras are revered by the Mantra Marga, and there are two groups of the Mantra Margis. One is called the Shaiva Siddhanta, which you all know of, and the other is what Alexis calls non-Siddhantika groups. Non-Siddhantika groups. And in the non-Siddhantika groups, you've got various other subsects, perhaps the most important of which I'm going to talk about the Trika and the Kula. And the Krama. Don't worry about those just yet. So the Shaiva Siddhanta we'll look at for now. Now the Shaiva Siddhanta became orthodox kind of Shaivism in South India. It began in the north in Kashmir, where it was a system of ritual and jnana, knowledge, cognition. And when it went to the south, it got influenced by Tamil Bhakti. It became a devotional kind of movement, as it still is today. And you get these big temples, in like Chidambaram in South India, which are Shaiva Siddhanta temples. But in the north, it was a knowledge-based system. And it was the emphasis was on ritual. So you became initiated into the Shaiva Siddhanta tradition. And at death, you would attain liberation. And what's liberation? Liberation is Shiva Tulya, equality with Shiva. So you become like Shiva, but you don't merge with Shiva, you become a Shiva. So you become exactly the same as Shiva, but numerically distinct from Shiva. you get Diksha. What's this system about? What is it still about? It's about Diksha, initiation. There's a very famous text edited by and translated by Bruno Lachaud, which transformed our understanding of Shaivism, this text did, in her edition, four volumes, in which he describes different initiations. And there's the Samaya Diksha, which is the normative initiation, which gives you access to the cult of Shiva. The text, you can read the text having undergone the Samaya Diksha. And then there's the Nirvana Diksha, which guarantees you liberation. And these were sometimes done one following the other, so it's really effectively kind of one initiation. So you have a mandala, and the devotee would be blindfolded, taken into the mandala. Perhaps I think they sleep on the mandala as well, and then they record their dreams, tell their dreams to the master. And the initiation ceremony itself, the disciple is blindfolded, turned around three times, I think, then throws a flower into the mandala.
Mm.
And where it lands, that's the lineage, or the gotra, or the lineage of his devotion, and so on. And the mantras that he'll use throughout his life.
Mm.
Till he dies. And at death, through his actions, he'll achieve liberation. So the Nirvana Diksha wipes out karma, wipes out sanchitta, the accumulated karma over lifetimes. So you've still got your prarabdha, the karma that you've got for this lifetime. But what's been wiped out by the Nirvana Diksha is the sanchitta, the accumulated karma, and also the argument that any karma that's coming, these are three kinds of karma, they're all wiped out except this one, which you carry out for the rest of your life, and then at death you reach Shiva Tulya, Shiva, equality with Shiva. And how do you do that? You do it through action, through ritual action. Because, because consciousness is a substance, it's a dravya. So action can affect substance. And this was rejected by the Kashmiri Shaivas, who rejected the notion of that action leads to liberation. It's rather cognition, jnana.
So would that be karma yoga?
They don't use that term, but yeah.
You could
say that action, ritual action. What is ritual action? Ritual action is making offerings to an icon of Shiva and receiving a blessing three times a day. Purifying the body, the way I described last week, the Bhuta Shuddhi, purification of the body. Nyasa, imposing mantras on the body. Visualization, and then external worship. There's a character, there's another book by Davis called Worshipping Shiva in Medieval India, which has got photographs of the character who appears in all these books. I think he must make his living through doing rituals for Indologists. And there's some very interesting photographs of him kind of doing these rites, you know, the Bhuta Shuddhi rites and so on. He's also, as a much younger man, he's somewhere in Bruno Lachaud's book. It's interesting. He's still still doing it.
What are purification on the body?
It's a Bhuta Shuddhi. It's called the purification of the elements in the body, which means you imagine or visualize the elements, earth, air, fire and water, pervading the body from the feet to the knees to the thighs to the navel to the heart to the throat to the crown of the head.
Can we have that a bit more slowly, please?
Bhuta Shuddhi, you've got a body... And you imagine the earth pervading from the feet to the knees. So in the ritual, you breathe in the mantra of the earth, and it pervades from the knees to the feet. And then you breathe it out into its source. So you breathe out the earth element into its subtle origin, its tanmatra, which is smell.
So you breathe it in and then out again.
Yeah. You breathe
down
it in,
to the feet.
Down to the feet, and you breathe it out to a point in front of your face where it's dissolved. And then you do that with all of the elements. So the next one, the water goes to the knees, from the thighs to the knees, and then you breathe that out into its subtle element.
From the knees to the thighs?
Yeah.
To the hip?
The hip, yeah. And then the hip, this is to the heart.
To hip.
That's the water. water, it's fire, or air, or fire, I can't remember, fire. That's right. And then
from
air.
Hip to heart.
Yeah, then air from heart to the throat, and then from the throat to the crown of the head.
From
Akasha.
From heart to throat.
So when you've destroyed the body like that through breathing out the mantras, you also visualize a fire burning from the toe of your right foot. Up the body, burning your body to a pile of ashes, and then in your imagination, and then as a flood of water comes along, arising from your mantra recitation, washes it away. And
so you burn the right side in your imagination to the ash.
You burn the whole body to ashes, but
the whole body to
fire
ashes.
Fire starts in the big toe of your right foot.
I think it's based on the dictum, yatha pinde tatha brahmande.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
So this is the microcosm and there is a macrocosm. So to understand the brahmanda, you have to concentrate on your body.
Mm. That's right. The whole universe is contained
in
the body.
The whole philosophy of this symbolism is based on this.
That's right,
yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And that's in the Brahman is that quote, then, isn't it? So
there is a synchronism between the pinda and the brahmanda. So whatever
right.
is going within the body, that is what is happening outside.
Indeed. Yeah, so you get that correspondence. So having destroyed your body in your imagination, you then recreate a divine body through nyasa, through imposing mantras upon it. Because only a god can worship a god.
Mm-hmm.
And then... You visualize the deity, and then you have external offerings. It's terribly time-consuming.
That gives an interesting idea.
But
how many concepts? How many conceptions of the body are available in Indian?
That's right. How many
yeah,
conceptions
it's
of
so
the body?
So interesting.
Yeah, different models of the
yeah.
body. It's a very positive
sthula
evaluation
sharira,
of the body.
Sukshma sharira, karana sharira, and
yeah.
then this bhuta sharira.
Yeah. Yeah, subtle body, and yes, that's right. They've got all these different bodily systems, and they get kind of mapped onto
yeah.
each other in complex ways. It's very interesting. We could look at that next week, actually, rather than. Yeah, let's look at that next week. So that's the ritual, then. That's the ritual that you do.
And the mantras, we don't have time for you to give that to us.
I can't remember them.
Okay.
There's the five faces of Shiva. There's the
Panchamukhi.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Do you remember the mantras?
No,
no I don't.
I'm
not
initiated into this tradition, yeah, but I have read a bit.
They're easily. I mean, if you've got the same Shanga Padati here, I don't know.
Shiva Sutra Padati.
I don't know. We got it anyway. They're easily available. Readily available.
Yeah, this is Shaivism.
No, we haven't got them, I don't think.
I was looking this morning.
We only got half a shop in China, isn't it? Jessica. Oh, no, come in if you want to. So, yeah. Okay, the other philosophy of this tradition, the three realities in the universe, Pati, the Lord, Pashu, and Pasha.
Pasha's
the world. The bond that ties the beast, and Pati's the Lord. So the goal of life is to free the Pashu from the
Pasha. And reach the Pati.
Reach the Pati. from the grace of Pati, through grace. So you do your rituals, you've got to do your rituals, but then it's also the grace of Shiva in the end that saves you. But you don't merge with Shiva, you become like Shiva, Shiva Tulya. You're equal to Shiva. But what's the difference then between Shiva and a liberated soul? The only difference is that the liberated soul doesn't have the five acts. The Shiva performs five acts, which is the creation of the universe, the maintaining of the universe, the destruction of the universe, the revealing of himself through grace, anugraha, and the concealing of himself to his devotees. So there's two functions, reveals and conceals himself. Very interesting. Why would he do that? Shiva Drishti talks about Shiva being a king and going amongst his foot soldiers, pretending to be a soldier, an ordinary common soldier, and that's concealing himself from himself. So these three distinct ontological realities. In Kashmiri Shaivas and non-Siddhantika traditions, they rejected that these were ontologically distinct, that they're actually one. They're merged in pure consciousness. It's got five functions. So that's Shaiva Siddhanta. Then it gets infused with a lot of Tamil devotionalism. And it was closed to women, this system. It still is Shaiva Siddhanta. You couldn't be initiated if you were a woman, but you got liberation through your husband. They participated vicariously through the husbands. Now, that was distinct from the non-Siddhantika traditions, which in which women participated. So that's the Shaiva Siddhanta, which reveres, description in a few minutes, because I want to get on to the tantric traditions. The more typically tantric traditions, prototypical ones. This is like Buddhism, it's like Mahayana Buddhism, if you like, to tantric Buddhism. So this is the normative system. That the non-Siddhantika traditions all assume this, and they're all built on top of it. So they're reinterpreted, of course, but they're sure that the Shaiva Siddhanta. Now, these non-Siddhantika traditions, they're the ones I want to focus on. And these are based on a group of texts called the Bhairava Tantras. And Bhairava was a form of Shiva, ferocious form of Shiva, fangs. And these are we have to. Do you remember I was talking about the Pashupata ascetics just now, living in cremation grounds. Well, you have to imagine a tradition of these cremation ground asceticism going on from the time of the Buddha, really. There's very interesting passages in the Pali Canon about monks meditating in cremation grounds, in the Vinaya Pitaka, very interesting material. And there's one story of a woman who comes and makes an offering to a monk, and her name is Kali. Very interesting. Why should she be called? Very early Pali Canon. A woman called Kali makes an offering to a monk in a cremation ground. So you have a tradition of cremation ground asceticism going way back, meditation on death, and the Buddhist meditation on decomposition of corpses and all that sort of rather gruesome material that you read in that text. And that tradition seems to carry on through into the tantric traditions. And here you have this cremation ground asceticism developing, in which there's a ascetics called Karpalikas, which in tantric, sorry, in Sanskrit literature become kind of lampooned as kind of monstrous characters, idiots, you know, who'd be imbeciles. But there were a sect or a group who lived in cremation grounds who carried a kapala, a skull, and they carried a katvanga, a skull-top staff. And so you can see the links with the Mahavrata, the ones who carried the skull of the Brahmin, the Lakunishan ascetics. And kapala is, of course, cognate with our word cup, English cup, the cognate. So cups and skulls. And skål in bowl in Scandinavia is cognate with skull.
Mm.
So cups, skål lager. None of you will drink skål lager. You might. skulls. Cups and skulls. Cups and skulls. Skulls and cups. Interesting. So, yeah, the Kapalikas were cremation ground ascetics who cover themselves, whereas the Pashupatas cover themselves in the ashes of cow dung, these cover themselves in the ashes of the cremation ground. So they're polluted, consciously polluting themselves. And these were regarded as unseeables by highly orthodox Brahmins. So if you saw a Kapalika, you had to stare into the sun to purify your eyes, because it was so polluting. And these became transformed into the current Agoris and Benares, which is almost like a kind of a new age religion now, I think. You get lots of middle class followers of some Agori ascetics. Kinnaram, is it Kinnaram? Is one famous one.
Kinnaram,
is it? Yes, famous ascetic, Agori ascetic. There was an interesting program about an Agori ascetic on the TV about 5-6 years ago. Did you see that, where he left home and became an Agori ascetic, and he was looking for his skull and he had difficulty finding his skull.
He was Western?
No, he was Indian. He had all this trauma at home. It was a very interesting story, his personal narrative, why he became an ascetic. Looking for his skull, and he wanted to go home at one point, but his guru wouldn't let him. It's quite funny. So
it's
extreme
penance, isn't it?
Extreme penance, yeah. The other part of the practice is meditation on the corpse. And we sit on the corpse and meditate on the corpse, literally on it.
And more, I have read. Which is really goes beyond, doesn't it?
Yes, they yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's part of the penance too.
Part of, yeah. Kinnaram urinates on his disciples from his balcony as a kind of blessing.
It is fascinating, though, isn't it, to wrap one's mind around that?
Yeah. Yes, what on earth is this about? So, the other thing about these cremation ground asceticism is that they're courting pollution and they're breaking taboos. They're breaking the norms of social norms, Vedika values. They're corrupting or challenging Vedic values. And they're offering blood, meat and alcohol to ferocious deities in the cremation grounds who demand blood, meat and alcohol, who demand to be appeased by blood, meat and alcohol. And they're also practicing controlled possession, avesha maram, enter me. You evoke Guya Kali or someone, and you perform a ritual so that she enters you, and you can get control of her, and she gives you power. So what are they after? They're not asking. Who cares about them? Who wants liberation? We want power in this world, in higher worlds, to experience bliss in other worlds. To become a universal monarch, in a sense, like a Chakravarti type figure. And this is why these traditions became very attractive to medieval kings, to kings in medieval India, who patronized these Kapalika groups.
Mm.
And there was one, I mentioned him last week, Bhatta Narayana. He was extremely disturbed by the king's patronage of these extreme tantric cults. And possibly he's got it put in prison because of it. But anyway, he Well, he defended the revelation of the Tantras, but he didn't like these more extreme groups. So they advocated offering of blood, meat and alcohol, which are all polluting substances forbidden to Brahmins, to ferocious goddesses. And they practice caste-free sex in the cremation grounds. That's the story, whether they did or not. So there must have been some relationship between the ascetic groups and low-caste groups who supported them.
It's what we would call black magic, probably.
Kind of black magic,
it?
That's right, black magic, yeah. There's a big tradition of that. The six magical acts, attraction, destroying enemies, those kinds of things. That's what they were practicing, yeah. In order to gain siddhi power.
Mm.
And this was a cult. These were cults and traditions, very attractive to kings, and they got a lot of royal patronage later on in the medieval period. Now, these groups, these Kapalika type groups living in the cremation grounds, are not only worshipping Bhairava or Shiva; they're worshipping a goddess. And these goddess traditions become known as the Kula traditions or Kaula traditions. And there's another tradition called the Krama. So there are three traditions, the Prika, the Kula and the Krama. These become particularly important cremation ground, or traditions whose origins are in the cremation grounds. And if you want to draw a line, I haven't got room there, of conformity to Vedic values. Okay, here's a Veda. And here's the Tantra traditions. Alexis draws a similar diagram somewhere in one of his articles. So you've got, this is sort of conformity to Vedic values. You've got the Shaiva Siddhanta are there. You've got smarter Brahmins, smarters there, they completely conform to the Vedic values. The Shaiva Siddhanta partially conform to the... they completely conform to the Vedic values, but they say, actually, we have another revelation, the Tantras, to add on to the Vedic revelation, that fulfills the Vedic revelation. And then you've got other groups, like the further down here, you get the more you get the Vedic values rejected. So at this extreme beam, you've got this Kula tradition and the Krama, which are cults originating in the cremation ground amongst ascetics, producing their own texts, which they regard as revelation, such as the Rudra Yamala. And
Kularanava?
Yes, Kularanava. That's a later text, Kularanava. Yeah. And claiming that the Vedic tradition is based on inhibition, or shankar, inhibition, and that to get liberated, to get free, you have to break inhibition, smash inhibition. So you therefore reject Vedic values, because they limit your consciousness. They constrain you and limit you. So if you smash Vedic values, you gain freedom.
Like the early encounter groups.
A bit like early encounter groups, that's right. I think that's a good parallel, yeah, a bit like that.
Shouting at each other.
Smashing each other up with sticks.
Reactionary forces.
And of course, the Vedicas were horrified by all this pollution. And then you get the Trika, which is kind of, further along towards the Vedic values, but still not completely. Then you get three stages of the Trika that Alexis has shown, the last stage being much more acceptable to the Orthodox, being a sort of cleaned up Trika, the Trika stripped of its cremation ground origins. So what's called Kashmiri Shaivism is often the cleaned up Trika tradition as represented by Abhinavagupta. Who's an Orthodox Brahmin and who takes the Trika texts and, as we'll see, and
gives his own interpretation of it and strips it of its cremation ground origins because he wants to universalize the philosophy. Because he believes it's a universal truth, the truth of the text that he's talking about. So I don't want to push him too far. So these, the third bit over here, you've got the more of the rejection of Vedic values, the more caste-free sex, the more drunkenness and offering blood and alcohol to bloodthirsty deities you've got, and the more over here, the more conformity to Vedic norms and values, the Varnashram Dharma you've got. So here's Varnashram Dharma, and this is outside of the pale, which rejects it.
I was just curious. I was just curious. Was it were these lower castes, were they separated first by the Brahmanas, and then sort of as a reaction to this separation, discrimination, they took up these values, or was it the other way around that due to these things they were sort of
probably the former? But it's very difficult. We don't know. There's all speculation about the social reality of these groups. These tantras are written in bad Sanskrit, which Abhinavaguptra and others like other Shaiva Siddhantins are embarrassed by. They call it Aisha, sacred language. So they were obviously composed by groups who weren't that well educated, but wanted to present their text as being sacred language of Sanskrit. So there were, what the social reality of these groups was is very difficult to say. There may be some more inscriptional evidence and archaeological evidence that Alexis knows about, but I don't know about it. So the standard kind of tantric system then, if you like, is represented by Abhinavagupta. Is based on the trika, on the revelation of the text of the trika. What is it? What's trika? Trika means threefold, and it's based on. What's the time? I'm supposed to stop talking, really. Shall I stop talking?
It's 5 minutes.
Ah, 5 minutes. Well, we've got till half past. So.
Mm.
But I don't want to overload you with information.
Yeah.
No,
okay.
Trika.
It's based on three goddesses. Parar, supreme, Parapara, non-supreme, and Aparapara, supreme. And they're all manifestations of a goddess called Kala.
This terminology is being used in various schools. Para. Mm.
Ah, yes, that's right. It's
yeah.
used in different contexts.
It started from Mundaka Upanishad.
Oh, yes, in Mundaka Upanishad.
Yeah, Veditavya, Paracha, Iva, Aparacha.
Ah, I didn't know it went back to that. That's very interesting.
Mm.
That's in the Mundaka.
How the terminology is travelling, that's
yes.
what I was just
yes.
wondering.
Yes. This is... They're manifestations of a goddess called the Kala Sankarshini. The destroyer of time, or the attractress, the one who attracts you, pulls you in. And she's a form of Kali. So these are manifestations, and they're worshipped in the system on a trident. Which, if you read Alexis's works, you'll see a nice picture of this trident mandala. There's the trika worships, it's not a mandala. Well, it's not a mandala in the sense of a realm thing. It's a trident mandala, and you worship these goddesses in your imagination, and they pervade your body. The trident pervades your body to the crown of the head, and you visualize them perform that kind of system of worship that I described earlier with these goddesses. And then you, in the trika, you inscribe their name, their mantras on a skull in front of you, and worship, perform external worship to your deities on the skull. Now, Abhinavagupta comes along and takes this system and reinterprets it in terms of his own monistic, non-dualistic philosophy.
And this system is based on the text called the Mahanamuhi Jayotra Tantra. Was a root text of this tradition, which has yet to be translated. There are sections of it rendered into English. Abhinavagupta wrote a commentary on the first chapter of it. But it's an interesting text, difficult to read. But Haneda, this fellow called Haneda, wrote a book called the Abhinavagupta's Philosophy of Revelation, in which is an excellent account of that. That text, and also some Dave Vasudeva has written a book called The Yogas of the Mahanamuhi Vijayotra, in which he shows how it absorbs different systems of yoga within it. But this is a terribly important central one. So Abhinavagupta's philosophy then is a kind of idealism, which says that there's only one reality of consciousness in the universe, and all appearance is an abhasa, manifest an appearance of consciousness, some of it, or chitta. So it's a rejection of the ontological, three distinct ontological realities of Shaiva Siddhanta, saying the only reality ultimately is consciousness, some of it. And subjects and objects of consciousness are ultimately delusional ways of speaking, because there's only one reality in the universe, which is Sambit, or consciousness. There's two kinds of language in Abhinavagupta. One is an uncompromising non-dualism. So he says, how can there be any distinction between purity and impurity if there's only one reality in the universe? On the other hand, you get a language of emanation, abhasa. So the world is an emanation of consciousness, so it's a slightly different kind of language. It's very difficult to maintain a purely non-dualistic language all the time, because language itself is dualistic. So you do get some passages in which Abhinavagupta uses pure non-dualistic language, but mostly there's a kind of emanationism creeps in all the time. Here's a passage that I've written on here. The Supreme Lord is the essence of his own light and our own self. By what means, then, is he to be achieved? If there's only one reality in the world, how can you achieve it? How can you reach that goal? Due to his own light, he cannot be known. Due to his eternity, his essence cannot be attained. Due to the non-existence of a covering over consciousness, there cannot be the cessation of a covering over consciousness. Due to the absence of a distinct penetration of God, there cannot be any penetration of the Lord. What then is the method? If it is distinct, it cannot be accomplished. Therefore, this totality is of a single reality of consciousness only, undivided by time, unlimited by space, unclouded by constraints, unobstructed by forms, unsignified by word, unmanifested by means of knowledge. So if there's only one reality, which is consciousness, how can you attain it? Because that implies you're here and that's over there and you can get there. Yeah. Which is not the case if there's only one reality. Yeah. So how can there be any reality which is impure? On the other hand, you've got this emanationist doctrine, which says that actually you get Shiva at the top of the universe, who emanates out in these various forms down to solidified matter. There's a very common trope in the tantras: as sweets are a coagulation of sugarcane juice, so the world is a coagulation of the essence of Shiva, and it does not lose its sweetness, says Maheshwarananda. Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Nice one, yeah. So that's the emanation of the universe down to the earth. The yogi, or the sadhaka, wishes to reverse that, and so the journey back to Shiva, back to who you really are, is a journey through the universe, and also which is a journey back through your own body, because the body and the universe are coterminous. So I'm going to stop talking for a minute. It's supposed to be a seminar, not a lecture, so... You can tell us about the Ugaris then.
Sorry, I had a couple of questions. It's just clarification, is it okay?
Yeah, sure.
So first, the first question is like, so who is the Kapaligas then, and how are they related to non-Siddhanticas?
Yeah, that's a good question. My reading of Alexis's article in 1988 was that the Kapalikas were cremation ground ascetics who were producing, if you like, some of the early non-Siddhantika tantras.
Oh.
But more recently, he seems to have revised that position and thinks that the Kapalikas are related to the Atimarga, part of the Atimarga, Pashupata tradition.
Oh.
So, but they're distinct from the Pashupatas in that they cover themselves in cremation ground ash rather than.
So non-Siddhantika tradition comes from Kapalikas?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then how?
I'm slightly qualified there because the Shaivasiddhanta doesn't directly come from the Kapalikas. Sorry, non-Siddhantika.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
And then also, Trikakula Krama, they come from Kapalikas as well.
I think the Kapalikas is not the name of a sect, but the name of a kind of movement or orientation. So they come from within the context of the Kapalika cremation ground tradition.
Uh-huh. And then you mentioned the Kali in this context. So are they like those who follow Kapalika practice, but who emphasizes Kali worship?
The Trika, particularly the Krama, are cremation ground traditions. And we have texts, Krama texts, which talk of consciousness emanating out and contracting back in. So it's a different system to the Trika. But they're certainly living in cremation grounds and probably taking lots of drugs or something, I don't know, but they're very visionary kind of texts. And consciousness emanating out from the body is oscillation, it's spanda, vibration, which gets picked up in later tradition as well. In fact, here's a Krama. A text. Do you want to take one across the map? There should be. This is the Dehastha Devata Chakra Stotra, which is a Krama text. Now we've run out.
That's okay.
I'll give you that in a minute. Which is Om Homage to Ganesh, Om Holy. I praise Ganapati, that's Ganesh, whose body is the inhaled breath. You know, we're talking about the universe in the body. Who is worshipped at the beginning of 100 philosophical systems, who delights in the bestowal of desired wishes. I praise Vartuka, known as the inhaled breath, who removes people's... Or the exhaled breath, that should be. Good heavens, there's an error. Known as the exhaled breath, who removes people's pain. His feet are worshipped by the lineage of perfected ones, the hordes of yoginis and the best heroes. That's the Siddhas. I always praise the pure, true master, the Satguru, whose nature is consciousness, whom the goddesses of the senses constantly worship in the lotus of the heart with the pleasures of their own sense objects. Now the sense object Vishaya there, the term Vishaya, has also the connotation of body, perhaps. It's not... I don't know how widely that is true in Sanskrit literature. Vishaya as object, sense object, sometimes be used as body, is that right?
Yeah, the body uses the Vishaya.
Yes.
Yeah, that is the Vishayi, and the external world is
Vishaya.
Vishaya.
Yes. Yeah. And I praise Ananda Bhairavi. That's Ananda Bhairava is a form of Shiva. Ananda Bhairavi is his consort, whose nature is awareness, who continually performs the play of creation, manifestation, and tasting of the universe. Those are Krama categories. And they exist in sexual union in the centre of this mandala that you imagine.
I constantly bow to Brahmani. These are the seven mothers, the Saptamatrikas, whose nature is the higher mind, the buddhi, situated on the pedestal of the Lord of Gods, who worships Bhairava with flowers of certainty, and so on and so on and so on. So he goes through these seven mothers, which you've got to imagine. I should have brought one along, but there's ritual. The manuscripts of this text, it's a hymn set within a ritual diagram, set within a context of a ritual in which you have a lotus like this. Well, better than that, but with Shiva, Ananda Bhairava, Ananda Bhairavi in the centre, and all these different deities located at the other. Imagine visualising the heart, and you do your ritual with this visualisation. So you recite this hymn as part of your liturgical process. And right at the end, verse 14 is quite interesting, having gone through all the different goddesses who worship different aspects of the body to different senses, to Bhairava in the centre. He says, I praise constantly the Lord of the body, who gives perfection, known as the self, united with the 36 categories, that's the tattvas, which I haven't spoken about. He is worshipped as the Lord of the six systems of philosophy. In this manner, I praise the circle of deities innate within the body. An elevated assembly continually present, the end of everything vibrant, and the essence of experience, the Anubhavasara, the essence of experience. There we are, that's the hymn.
What is this text, is from?
It's called the Dehastha Devata Chakra Stotra.
Dehastha Devata Chakra Stotra.
And
it's a manuscript.
It's a manuscript, yeah. It's published, it's published in Pandey's Abhinavagupta, his book on Abhinavagupta, in an appendix. And it's published by Lillian Silburn in a French translation. But
so, however, they may say that they are going against the Vedic values, but there is definitely the Vedic influence in all this.
You see,
we have a verse in Atharva Veda where this body is characterized as Devanam Puhu.
Yes.
Ashta Chakra Navadvara Devanam Pur Ayodhya. The body is Ayodhya actually.
Where
there is no battle between the elements and everybody is working in coordination.
Yes.
So Devanam Puhu. This
yes.
is a city of the Devas.
Yes.
Ashta Chakra Navadvara Devanam Pur Ayodhya Tasyam Hiranyayo Koshah Swargo Jyotishavrata. So everything you read, you just think of the Vedic verses, and you can see the influence. So
That's fascinating.
They may say Dehastha Devata. So this word itself reminds you of the Deho. Then they have Deho Devalaya Proktaha.
I think it's often underestimated that the influence of the Vedic.
So there should be a study on this interrelation or the influence.
Yes. This intertextuality. I mean, these texts probably directly.
And now from mantra, we went to tantra. Now we are going to the yantra.
Oh, yes.
There is a whole.
Sorry, just different question. But the you said the non-Siddhantika tradition, and within that tradition, there is this big name Abhinavagupta, and then he basically interprets. Malinibhijotra, which is the sort of root text, and then kind of reads in his monistic philosophy. So I guess my first question is that if you just read that root text itself, is it more like a dualistic?
Well, Alexis thinks it's a dualistic text, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, where is this non-dualism coming?
Yes, where is it coming from? Very good question, Kira. It seems to be coming from these cremation ground traditions now, where they're getting it from. Are they getting it from their ecstatic sort of experiences of in the cremation grounds because they're meditating too much or not getting enough to eat or something, or the hallucinations?
So these Kapalikas, they do, like, even prior to Abhinavagupta's formulation of non-dualistic Shaivism, so they had already.
Speculation, because we don't have any texts, I don't think.
But they sort of embrace the non-dualistic philosophy.
I think so.
Oh, okay.
I think so. But Alexis would be able to tell you more about the Kapalika doctrines. But if we don't have texts, it's a problem. Certainly these, I mean, something like the Dehasadeva, it's quite an early text, but and that's a non-dual, it's a sort of non-dualistic text in a way. But the Krama and the Kula texts are fairly non-dualistic, but Abhinavagupta says the Trika text is a dualistic text, and he makes that claim because it's got this hierarchy of experience. So you have the cosmos, there's pure creation, Shuddha Sarga, and there's impure creation. And this is the Tattva hierarchy, of course. And at the top here, you've got these beings called them three classes of mantras. The mantras are made for God in this system. The mantreshras and the maha mantreshras. And then you get the Vijnana Kevalas, the consciousness only beings who live at a certain level of the universe, but who seem to live between the impure and the pure creation, is a bit ambiguous. Then you get the Palaya Kevalas, and then you get the Sakalas. So we're all Sakalas, we're all beings with particularity in this universe. There are other beings. If we practice some yogic practices, we could become pralaya kevalas, which means that at the end of a great cosmic contraction, we would go into this state of pralaya.
Mm.
But then at the end of that, you get thrown out again into the universe. And then the vijnana kalas, who have only consciousness, and they have there are three pollutions in this tradition, called anava, or individuality. And they have the pollution of individuality still within them. The pralaya kevalas have the pollution of... I can't remember what it is now. There's three pollutions. Anava, individuality, maya, illusion. And these have the pollution of karma mala. So these three malas, which operate at this high level of the impure universe, govern these three classes of beings. So why am I describing this? Oh yeah, this is in the Manini Vijayotra Tantra, this system.
Mm.
So it's very close to the Shaiva Siddhanta that also adopts this system. And that in that text and other texts, you get this system mapped onto the Tattva hierarchy, and that mapped onto other the system called Kalas, different levels of the universe. So you get these very complex mappings in these texts.
So how would the Kula and the Krama tradition, how would they differ from Trika, or how
they differ in the sense that the Kula, the Trika, worships these three Kala Sankarshani. I think the Kula and the Krama. The Krama has a, I don't know about the Kula, but the Krama has a different system of categories that it uses. Five categories, which I forget what they are now. But the last of which is light as their central category. You'd have to, Alexis's works will have on this description. But often, I must admit, I'm a bit vague about the distinctions between the Trika and the Kula, because they seem to sort of merge into each other. Because one of the reasons being that at the Trika tradition distinguishes between two systems, the Tantra Prakriya and the Kula Prakriya. Now, the Tantra Prakriya is the normative rite of the Trika practitioner, which involved visualizing the trident mandala and worshipping the goddesses on a skull and all that kind of thing. And then the Kula Prakriya is the esoteric secret rite in which you worship the goddess through sex. You offer her
sex with a low caste duty. And I mean, I've got from chapter 29 of the Tantraloka, describes this distinction between these two. Now, this is a secret esoteric rite. So the kula is, if you like, the esoteric heart of the tricker, you could say that.
Hmm.
The kula is the esoteric heart of the tricker, in which the sadhaka and the duty reflect or recapitulate the Ananda Bhairava and Ananda Bhairavi in their yogic practice, into which you have to become initiated. So these are the two ritual systems in the tricker tradition. Does that clarify that?
Mm-hmm. But Abhinavagupta, as far as I understand, according to him, the liberation is attainable through knowledge.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, and if he's wanting to kind of elevate the image of Shaiva tradition,
mm-hmm.
why didn't he just cut off these esoteric practicing?
It's good question, Q. I don't know the answer to that. Why did he cut off these? Logically, he should have been a pure non-dualist, if you like,
yeah.
and stripped it of all this kind of
yeah.
cultic affiliation. But he
yeah.
never did. He always wanted. He thought this was the heart of the tradition, the kula practice. So there's that famous quote where you're Vedic in your social observance. And you're Shaiva in your privacy, but in your heart you're a Kaula, practitioner of the Kula tradition.
Because the environment in which he was living and in which he was brought up, so that reflects.
Yes,
mm.
that's right. This was a social taboo,
yeah.
doing all this kind of Kula practice.
Yeah.
But he nevertheless thought it was important because it was it achieved a liberating cognition. That's what he thought.
What did you say?
Yeah.
The practice was carried out with a lower class.
A duty was a messenger. But probably, well, it says in the text, yeah, a lower caste woman. Well, actually, somewhere in the Tantra, it says any member of your family if you can't find one.
So they were presumably uninvolved.
Who? According to the Tantraloka, if you read that chapter, it's this enlightenment is supposed to occur in both partners. It seems clear about that.
But why then lower caste?
Again, it's a taboo breaking thing, I think.
Okay.
Shattering expectations.
Who's wondering, probably we don't know, but these females who would be involved in these traditions, in what context could they be brought into this? I mean, you don't just decide I'm going to be Kashmir Shaiva, a Kula practitioner, by dad, off I go to have sex down Greta. But, in what context it was possible to do that?
Yeah, exactly. What is
it?
Very interesting question.
Family, makes that possible.
There is a lot missing, isn't there?
The Snellgrove's got in his book in Esoteric Buddhism talks about the text that describes different systems of signs whereby you'd recognise another practitioner. Something. I don't know, a nod and a wink or something. Esoteric signs, but to what extent any of this was a social reality, and to what extent it was just mythology made up in the minds of these Brahmins, who knows? But certainly, these traditions were very vibrant and very rich. And what's interesting is, say, in Jayarata's commentary on the Tantraloka. His chapter 29, his commentary on the Kula rite, he's quoting loads and loads of texts which we don't have, which are lost. There's obviously a very rich tradition going back several centuries of these rites, which are textually instantiated, most of which is gone.
Mm.
So, talking about incredibly, pretty mainstream tradition in medieval India, which got lost, really, which got kicked out, got crushed. got squeezed up by later invasions and a more sort of puritanical, I suppose, puritanical kind of Hindu tradition becoming dominant.
Can I ask about I'm just trying to get a sense of the kinds of dualism that are involved here, because we always say dualism, but it always seems to be rather more complicated than that. And particularly in Shaiva Siddhanta, where it's nominally dualist, yes, and it's grace that gets you to God. The world isn't God, and you just realize it. But that liberation is to become a Shiva, in a sense. It's an interesting story by itself, and one wonders what is involved in one aiming to become another Shiva, just how that psychologically what's involved in that. But metaphysically, is there any account made of this? What it means for there to be Shiva to give you grace to become another?
Well, yes, it's odd, isn't it? Not that I know, but Alex would know all that. No quiz to answer that question. But I think the non-dualists thought it was incoherent. I mean, you become a Shiva. You're equal to Shiva, but you simply don't. You have all the powers of Shiva, but out of politeness, you don't create, destroy, and maintain the universe. Because he got there first. it's a rather odd kind of view. It's a bit like it comes from Samkhya, where you get innumerable Purushas who are numerically distinct, but qualitatively the same.
But then they're all the witness in some sense.
Yeah.
Is Shiva in that context also said to be connected to consciousness, or is that
he still has consciousness? Yes,
but he's not universal consciousness.
Not universal consciousness. Because Shakti is Jada, is unconscious, which is the universe. So we covered a lot of. I didn't mean to do all this today, but we covered a lot.
I was just thinking this idea of getting the form of or becoming a Shiva in Shaivism is sort of comparable to some ideas in the Sri Vaishnava tradition, where you get like one of the types of mukti is Svarupya Mukti, where you get the same form as Vishnu
interesting.
In Vaikuntha.
Yeah.
But it's very clear to everyone who is the actual Vishnu. But
how do they know?
Through signs, he has a different conch, four signs. Shivatsa also.
Yeah.
So there's specific signs, and also, I guess his being is different.
Yeah,
so his
quality.
Presence, sort of, yeah.
It's interesting. It's very similar, since Shivantudya.
It's funny because it sounds so much like a kind of mythologized, cloaked non-dualism. Then you will become one with God. I mean, you won't actually become one with God. You'll just look a bit like him.
Yeah, just look a bit like him. You'll be the same as him, except numerically
except
distinct.
Quote. Yeah, exactly.
So next time we might look at non-dualism a bit more, and perhaps look at Pancharatra. I've raced through a lot of material here. I'm sorry if you feel a bit steamrolled, but we could look at arguments. I've never got to non-dualistic arguments.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay, we'll do that. Thanks for coming, everybody.
Thank you.
Are you going to do anything on Kundalini?
Oh, that's a good point. Okay, I'll do that next week.
Next week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good idea.
Thank you.
I don't know how to turn this off, really.
I have just the record button.
Oh, no.